You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Have you ever wondered why you might find yourself lingering before a painting or a sculpture you were unfamiliar with for a longer time than usual? You can't put your finger on why exactly, but you know you like it. A new exhibit at the Walters Art Museum in Baltimore is an experiment designed to investigate why and how art stimulates perceptual mechanisms in the brain. Beauty in the Brain, a Neural Approach to Aesthetics, is a collaboration between the Walters Art Museum and the Zanvi Krieger Mind Brain Institute at the Johns Hopkins University. Joining us now to discuss the exhibit are Niraja Balachander, a neuroscience graduate student who's leading the project at Zanvi Krieger, and Gary Vikan, director of the Walters Art Museum and curator of the show. Welcome to our show. Hi.
Terrific to be here,
Hi.
Leonard. Thank you.
Gary, what works of art are included in the exhibit?
Well, we only have one work of art. This is the oddest show you'll probably ever see. One work of art, and it's really not even part of the experiment itself. It's a beautiful 1959 Jean Arp, The Woman of Delos, which is being lent by the Cockwright Gallery in New York. But we use it as an example of how the exhibition works, the experiment works, because what these wonderful folks, Neerja and her colleagues at Hopkins, have done is to essentially iterate a work of art in multiple shapes and then invite the visitor with 3D glasses, the old 1955 red-green things, on, seeing them in three dimensions to make choices of what their most favorite shape is. And so they're actually looking at 10 panels, each of which has a multiplicity of slightly different shapes, one from the other.
Well, Jean Arp is an abstract artist, a great one, generally considered to be a great one. But his work is amorphous shapes, not expressionist, not strictly geometric. Is that important that they're amorphous so that they people actually can read things into them?
Well, from our point of view at the museum, having no iconography per se simplifies the world, and I would defer to Neerja on the issue of the kind of brain function questions that can be complicated if the shape you're looking at is referential.
Well, Neerja, what happens if people say, I just don't like abstract art?
That's surely a question. So the professor that I work for, my advisor, Dr. Ed Connor, has pioneered a lot of quantitative studies to try and understand how the brain kind of perceives shape. And for that, we need shapes to be more than geometric idealizations. We need them to be a little more complex than merely squares and hexagons and spheres. At the same time, we need them to be not too complicated, not some Michelangelo, so we can't actually quantitate anything about them. So art falls in that narrow kind of niche where we can, I mean, there is enough complexity that we know that people can read shapes into them, people can perceive them, and there are convexities. It looks biomorphic. At the same time, it's within our grasp. It's mathematically quantifiable.
And what questions are you asking these people who are looking at the work, both the real work and these 3D images?
So most of the exhibit consists of 10. 10 arrays where there are tight variations around a given shape. That is, there is a small variation either along either a row or a column in either thickness or, let's say, the bluntness or some kind of shape parameter. And what we want people to do is put on their 3D glasses, look at each of these exhibits, and tell us what they actually prefer and what they least prefer in each of these exhibits.
And we're calling the study neuroaesthetics?
That is correct.
Now, in the past, of course, there have been many philosophers who've dealt with the whole matter of why certain things appeal to us more than others. I've read all sorts of theories. Are you actually looking into how the brain reveals why certain things appeal to us more than others?
Yes, as a part of the study at Hopkins, I mean, this is twofold. So one, as Gary will tell you more about, is the exhibit that's going on right now at the Walters. But on the other hand, we have a more scientific controlled experiment that's going on in the lab where subjects are seeing more and more of these exhibits, and they point to us what their preference and their lack thereof. And also we... pick a few of these subjects and we take them for functional magnetic resonance imaging experiments, which can point to us, what the brain areas are doing actually, or some correlate of what the brain areas are doing when these people actually have this aesthetic experience.
And can you see when does the certain parts of the brain light up on the MRI when somebody sees a painting or a sculpture that's appealing rather than something that's less appealing?
So, I mean, these kind of experiments have been done before. I think what we're asking is a slight variation on it. So most of the experiments in aesthetics that have been done are, where does it light up? What is does it light up for something being appealing and something being less appealing? I think what we're asking is, given that this person likes certain shapes, or given that person finds this, a subject finds a certain shape aesthetically pleasing, what is special about that shape? What is it that the brain do differently for this shape? So in some ways, we're trying to understand the attributes of the shape that make something more aesthetically appealing, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Gary, you say that the artist is intuitively a neuroscientist.
Well, I didn't invent the idea, but it sounds so right to me. I came at this more from traditional aesthetics philosophy. And my point of departure in the museum is Clive Bell, 1914, and this notion of significant form, this idea that some shapes just are inherently more pleasing. And that whole idea informs the Barnes Collection in Philadelphia, or outside Philadelphia, where Albert Barnes and John Dewey kind of gave expression in that installation, that quirky installation.
Soon to be in Philadelphia, by the way.
Well, yeah, that some shapes are just inherently more beautiful than others, but the philosophical conversation ground to a halt because it was a circular argument. Who got to define what shapes are significant?
Now, can you describe the ARP sculpture and why this is what you chose?
Well, we chose it actually with the good counsel and advice of Ed and his team, Nirja, because it's complex enough to do the good work, but not so complex, as she said, as a Michelangelo might be, to have all kinds of references outside the realm of the work of art itself. But it's just a beautiful blobby shape, sort of like a lava lamp shape of 1972.
Mm-hmm. Nirja, what do we know so far about what the brain is aesthetically attracted to?
I think most of the studies that we have so far are more, let's say, qualitative. So what has been done is, asking people to just rate on a scale of 10, perhaps, what they find, paintings that they find beautiful, paintings that they find ugly, and then asking these people to do the same in an fMRI machine that is a functional magnetic resonance image machine, and, where you can see which parts of the brain light up, as you were just mentioning before. I think we're new entrants in this entire field. This field itself is fairly novel. It's new. It's just another way of looking at, a different question of the brain, that is how the brain assigns to a shape aesthetic value. What I mean is we see a shape, we perceive it, we can categorize it. It's effortlessly a three-year-old can tell you, looking at a picture, whether it's a leaf or a face. But along with that, we're also doing a higher function. With each of these shapes, we put a figure on it, we put a value on it, and that's the aesthetic judgment. What we are trying to do is understand how the brain is doing this, and this can give us some kind of information about possibly how the brain actually categorizes and studies shape, which is, the ultimate pursuit of Connor's lab.
I would assume that if you did these studies at different times throughout history, you'd get different results. There would have been a time when the ARP would have been shocking. Now it is something that we feel very comfortable with. Vermeer was once not popular. Now he is considered one of the greatest artists that ever lived, and we can go throughout the history of art and come up with many names like that. So how much of this is culturally controlled?
You've raised a very interesting point, Leonard, and I hope that this experiment is so successful, and it certainly is from the public's point of view. I mean, they're just stuffing our little ballot box with their opinions. I hope it's so successful that it will lead to other experiments that begin to look at things that do have outside references, that do have culturally defined references, and maybe even explore the avant-garde and what that means someday.
Although you seem to be interested in doing these kinds of experiments, can you describe what was done during the 2007 Gustave Courbet show at the Walters?
Oh, we commissioned music for atonal compositions, electronic compositions, to accompany the four seasons into which we'd organized these Courbet landscapes. And we did, in that case, affective kind of social science studies to find out how long people lingered in the exhibition. And we found out that, in fact, the music seems to have intensified their engagement with the work of art. In addition to that, we had the lights get brighter and less bright in an almost imperceptible cycle. And that, too, seemed to have caused people to spend more time engaging aesthetically. And we had no labels, virtually no labels at all.
I want to thank the two of you so much for talking with us. Gary Vikkand is director of the Walters Art Museum in Baltimore. Neerja Balachander is a neuroscience graduate student teaching, who's leading the project that's led to the show called Beauty and the Brain, Neural Approach to Aesthetics. That's at the Zanville Krieger Mind Brain Institute at Johns Hopkins University. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.